Hi guys, and welcome to our next episode on our journey on the NICU Resources Podcast. We are eternally grateful for the feedback you all have given us. We never in a million years imagined that this would take off the way that it has. We are both humbled and excited about this journey. For those of you who have not had a chance to check out our website, we do have one. It's NICU-resources.com. On this website, you can find a ton of different content. We all three have blogs. We have Darla, who dives into the pathophysiology of everything that we talk about. Rebecca and her nerd self gives you every nerd fact you ever wanted to know about babies and the NICU, and probably some you didn't really want to know either. Myself, my blog is about leadership and taking care of ourselves as nurses. So join us on our webpage and check us out. So we're going to dive in today to late preterm and moderate preterm babies. I know we touched on late term in our last episode, but those 34-weekers still fall into that moderate preterm range too. So Darla, tell us about these little ones.
Well, I think the late preterm babies are still scaring you, Michelle. We're talking about moderately preterm in this episode, and moderately preterm is defined as 32 and 0 to 33 and 6 weeks. However, if a baby is 34 and 6 or younger, the baby is automatically admitted to the neonatal intensive care unit. And so when we are talking about this population, we are also lumping in your 34-week gestation babies in this moderately preterm category.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify that the reason we decided to sort of lump that in with moderate, even though they don't technically fit, so we're using the National Institutes of Health standard definitions for gestation. But the research shows that a NICU admission actually becomes its own risk factor. So these babies that are 34 weeks, they're guaranteed a trip to the NICU. And when we were talking about it, we felt like it was fair to include them, because as nurses or NICU specialists in whatever field, you're going to be seeing these babies. And we want you to think of the line between these late preterm and moderate preterm babies as more sort of hazy, fuzzy, rather than a super hard line that's drawn.
So, I think that's really fair. I kind of like how you stated that. It's not a hard line.
No, and the truth of it is, we mentioned last week and it continues, we term gestation and a baby's gestational age based on both the EDC, you know, when we expect that mom had conceived and when the baby is due, and also the way the baby clinically presents. And I know I am not the only nurse who has gotten a report on a baby that was, y'all can't see the air quotes, but there's air quotes here, the baby was 26 weeks, and you're looking at it going, there's no way. And so the struggle is always kind of looking at that. Do we go by the air quotes gestation? Do we go by what we see? And I think it's fair to say that it's all kind of a fuzzy line.
I think development alone is a fuzzy line.
Truth.
Mm-hmm. You know, and even with our babies, there's a fuzzy line. Some babies develop just a little faster than others.
I mean, to be fair, adult humans, it's still fuzzy.
Very fuzzy.
Very fuzzy.
I mean, everybody, different rate. Boys, right. Girls.
Yeah, there's different weight charts for boys versus girls, even in our preterm population. You know, I think, again, I think that it was pretty good that you stated it's these aren't hard lines. We kind of know what to expect at each gestation, but just like every kindergartner is not doing the same thing on the first day of kindergarten, we can't expect all of these babies to be doing the same things.
Right. It goes back to nature versus nurture.
Well, there's that too.
You think about it, a lot of these babies, nature, we hit the gestational age just based on this is when I was conceived, but nurture, how's that mom taking care of herself?
Right.
How is she nurturing this baby that's inside of her, and where is she going to have this baby land based on
how well she's been taken care of?
Right. I think we see that a lot in this population, especially. So 2/3 of these babies are born.
Well, wait a minute. Can we kind of rewind a little bit? And so we talk about, you know, how well has mom been taken care of? I think it would be really interesting to kind of present an episode on some disparities and inequities within this population.
Sure. So actually, that's one of the things that's maternally related. So 2/3 of these babies are born for something that has nothing to do with mom.
Right.
2/3 of these babies are born early because they're multiples, because there's congenital malformations. We don't know exactly why, but part of that 2/3 is also maternal age. Moms less than 20 and older than 35 are more likely to have babies born in this age range.
And serial pregnancies that are close together.
Yes. And also a previous preterm birth.
Correct.
Will make that mom more at risk. So you were talking about disparities. Some of that we know is related to socioeconomic status, is related to nutritional status. Moms who have very physical jobs that they can't step away from because maybe they're the sole breadwinner for their household means that they are more likely a lot of times to go into preterm labor, right? So there is a huge disparity that's part of this. The other thing is ethnicity. So we know that maternal education has an impact on the gestation of babies, right? More educated moms tend to carry closer to term. However, what we also know is that non-Hispanic Black moms who are college educated are still more likely to have a preterm birth than white moms who are also college educated. So if you took out anything that could separate one from the other and you just look at that ethnic background, there is a piece of that which, you know, is a whole different discussion about access and availability, but also kind of makes you wonder, you know, what are we going to find on the genome when we're mapping it?
And is it actually the genome or is it the delivery of healthcare itself?
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like when you look at access is healthcare delivery,
right,
and disparities in delivery, because let's be honest, there are huge disparities.
Yes.
There are huge disparities. But also it does bring a question to mind that, you know, will we find some of these ties that are actually at a deeper level than that are more genetic than they are exposure?
Right.
And I think obviously that's not something we're going to ever be able to talk about here, at least not for the next, I don't know, couple decades.
Right. I do think it would be interesting to cover that in its own episode.
Oh, for sure.
So, you know, like for today, we can kind of stick to what do we typically see for these babies.
So the other third of those babies, and Darla, you're going to take this and run with it because you're the one that knows all the mom things. But the other third are really going to be more related to actual maternal health factors.
Right.
So like infection, chorio is a huge thing. And especially when you talk about premature rupture, and then we can get into betamethasone and kind of how that can impact, and or we can save that for another day, but it's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. I think that we could kind of touch down on it again. You know, we're talking about a NICU resources podcast that we have, and so a lot of these things we really can take a deep dive into.
For sure.
And when you talk about premature rupture of membranes, we kind of touch down on that in our late preterm episode, where, you know, these babies are going to get, or these moms are going to get betamethasone if they have premature rupture of membranes. And what do we know about steroids? They mask infection. And so this baby really could be kind of swimming in some bacteria. But because mom has had steroids, we don't know it. She's not going to spike a temp.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it is part of the late preterm, but all of the moderate preterm babies,
yes,
are going to get that beta meth.
Yes.
Ideally, presumably, you know.
Mom presents in time
for that to,
yes,
happen. Even if mom presents and it's like an immediate pending, they're likely to get at least one dose.
They do try to get that one dose in. And if they can hold mom off for 24 to 48 hours, they will try really hard to do that, to get that betamethasone in. But, you know, if mom's rolling in at 10 centimeters and crowning,
yeah,
it's not happening.
Right, it's true.
You know, I've read some research that says even if you can get the betamethasone in, the benefits of it have been seen as early as 6 hours.
Yes. And most of the time, people will hope for the best.
Yeah.
Give it anyway and hope for the best.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, if mom kind of presents with preterm labor and she can get some magnesium, you know, max sulfate and kind of get the smooth muscle of the uterus to relax, even if she's dilated, you know, giving that magnesium sulfate could suppress labor enough to get the betamethasone in.
It does. That does happen frequently. I can't tell you how many times I've been in charge. And they're like, oh, we've got a 34-week mom up here. We're going to give her some mag, try to get her through the night, get that full effect of the betameth. And then once she hits that 48-hour mark, we're going to let her go.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and talk about the mag.
Yeah, let's talk. I want to talk. I think magnesium sulfate in this gestation, we see it a lot for preventing delivery. You know, with our late preterm babies, our term babies, and our post-date babies, those moms were getting mag to prevent seizure activity.
Right.
They're in their own bodies. These moms, these babies are getting exposed to mag because of preterm labor.
Right.
They may be exposed to it longer, maybe higher doses.
So what does that look like?
High doses of mag. I mean, it looks like magnesium toxicity. So mom gets really lethargic. She might stop breathing, which is never fun.
Oh my God, I can't even.
That is never fun. It's really scary. You know, you kind of go in and do these mag checks on these moms once an hour. And, you know, you get a call from a frantic dad and you're like, it's been 30 minutes. Like, what happened? And I mean, you go in there and mom is mag toxic. She's
terrifying.
Barely responsive.
Y'all, that's terrifying.
I mean, it's terrifying if you can't get calcium gluconate right away.
Yeah.
I mean, just not even the mom piece. I'm thinking about the babies that come out. That
okay.
Are, yeah. I was thinking about the babies that come out, which are also scary.
So when you're not, even when you're not mag, even when you don't have a mom that's mag toxic, what I will say about being at the numerous amounts of deliveries that I have been to as the baby nurse, and these babies come out and they're 34 weeks. I mean, at first they kind of come out screaming a little bit and you're like, great, that's cool. And you put, you know, this baby comes out and you're like, okay, this is awesome. We can kind of show mom and dad this baby. And then the baby's like, you know, I'm tired.
Yep. 35 seconds, I'm done.
I'm done. Thank you for the first Apgar of 9.
Yes.
My second one's probably going to be like 6.
Right.
Because I'm tired.
Right.
And they do. They get they tire out. It's almost like they come out with a burst of energy and then they're just done.
But you know what? How many days have I woken up with that same problem?
I know, right?
It happens.
It does happen. We can't blame the babies.
So when those babies come to the NICU, I know I learned very early that I don't trust them when they tell me that they're good because it almost never lasts. Like, they seem to do that. They kind of rally for a little bit. And I think that that's, you know, another part of this particular group is that they do a lot of times kind of come out trying to act grown. And we want to let them. And we say, sure, you can be a grown-up. We're going to treat you like a grown-up. And we're going to put you in clothes. And we're going to put you in a bassinet. And then the baby says, no, thank you.
The baby says no. The other thing I noticed a lot with babies who come, who are admitted into the NICU after having mag exposure, like, why do we expect these babies to poop right away?
You know, I've always wondered that. They're not gonna.
They're not gonna do it. No. This magnesium sulfate constipates their moms. It's gonna constipate them.
Right, right. Which gets into that whole thing, you know, another one of the complications with these kids is jaundice.
No, so equals jaundice.
Exactly. And you have these kids who are coming down with mag and they aren't stooling well. And, you know, they're kind of trying to act like they have some sense, only maybe they don't have as much sense as they think they have. And then, you know, they're not stooling on top of it.
Right.
That's when I feel like you get those babies that are like 33 and 6. 34 and 2.
And they're so cute.
And they're so cute. And you're like, oh, this is just going to be like a little blip on the radar. And 2.5 weeks later, you're like, oh my God, why are you still here?
And they're like, because you were asking way too much of me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they're so cute.
They really are. They're like a perfect snuggle size.
This might be the cutest gestation, I think.
You think?
I do. Do you think this is the cutest gestation?
I think so. Because
they're pocket sized and they're cute.
They are. They can just stick them in your pocket and carry them around.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in my pocket, they would stay warm.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Do you know, okay, nerd deviation for just a second, but it's totally worth it because it's these kids. So the very first, like, on purpose research, I have a hypothesis. I set out to do research on purpose, not like, oh my gosh, we did this thing and look at what happened and now let's see if we can recreate it. So the first, like, on purpose research was done in 1978 in Bogota because this age baby was getting cold.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have incubators and they didn't have the things to be able to keep the baby warm artificially. And they made mom come in and mom had to strap the baby to her. This is where a lot of the origins of kangaroo care and continuous kangaroo care and kangaroo mother care, and pick a term, they all apply. Where a lot of that came from, they found out that babies who are snuggled up to you, okay, maybe not in your pocket necessarily, but babies who are snuggled up to you will stay warm. And then they were having such a huge change in their outcomes and survival, you know, mortality and morbidity was dropping.
So I think I just had a flashback. This might have been the very first conversation that I ever had with you.
It's very possible. It's very possible. Like, I've been a nerd about these things for a long, 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 long time.
Like, it's really horrible. I don't always remember meeting people for the first time when I've known them for years and years, but I think that was the very first conversation.
Quite possibly. So, other than being pocket-sized.
And cute.
And cute. And not always as smart as we think they are.
Angry. Sometimes I feel like they're so angry.
They are. They are angry little souls, because the angry little soul thinks that it wants to eat a whole lot more than it can.
And then you put the bottle in the baby's mouth and they're like, thank you, but no.
I don't know what to do with this.
And then they wake up for their next care rounds angry again. And I'm like, can we put in psych consults on babies?
If only. I know quite a few babies that would benefit, yes. So the eating thing, though, it's an issue for them.
It is. And it's really interesting because I think a lot of people mistake the cues
right.
At this gestational age. They think that these babies are cueing so that they can eat a full bottle.
But, you know, some of the cues for eating when you're looking at hands to midline and all those are also comfort cues and not necessarily feeding cues.
Thank you, Michelle.
Right? So sometimes I feel like, you said, we think these babies want to eat bottles, and really they're just looking
for their
hands to comfort themselves and not necessarily to suck on that bottle to eat.
Right. Hands to midline and also a non-nutritive suck are really two of four.
I think,
self-soothing methods.
I think what these babies are really looking for is to get their hands on their oral gastric tubes so that they can get their hands up there and pop it out.
So I do have to actually
say, because
the
freestyle baby handbook.
This is, yes, and parents freak out about this. And really the truth of it is that babies don't have enough muscle strength to keep their hands by their face, and they know that that makes them feel comfortable. So whatever is there that they're going to be able to latch onto so that they don't lose that hand that they just worked so hard to find,
right.
They're going to grab.
And if there's any parents out there listening, first of all, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
But second of all, babies pull their OGs and their nasogastric tubes out all of the time.
All the time.
Like, it's their job at this gestational age to do that.
Y'all, I have a primary right now, and when I was getting report the other day, I looked in her bed. She had managed to take her CPAP and throw it onto the floor. She had pulled her feeding tube out, and it was in the bed, and she was just looking at me like, what?
Did something happen?
Actually, the look was more like, what? I told you I didn't like that.
Yeah.
And she's real opinionated. All right, so let's talk about feeding, though, and cues. And especially I want to talk about feeding and cues. You know, we have a friend who is looking at this for her facility.
Yes.
Because cue-based feeding is what most NICUs are doing right now. And there's a huge, I feel like, misunderstanding in nursing. You know, people think that cue-based feeding means you're telling me when to feed you, when really cue-based feeding is when you're telling me to stop feeding you, right?
Yes.
So let's talk about that some.
Sure. So this gestation, babies around, this is outside of this gestation, but babies around 28 weeks really start to find their hands in utero and they start to suck on their hands. It doesn't mean that they're ready to eat.
Right.
They're really just trying to coordinate.
So I feel like I always tell parents that this gestation is kind of like some people I know that they can do two things, but not three.
Right.
So they can suck and swallow. They can swallow and breathe. Or they can suck and breathe, but they can't suck, swallow, breathe.
Which is the important thing, is that babies can do all three consistently.
Right. So that doesn't actually really start to develop well until 34, 35 weeks.
34, 35 weeks. I mean, honestly, I've seen some 36 weekers out in newborn that they don't get it.
Right.
They can't do it. And they're, I mean, like 36 weeks and the parents call you into the room and they're like, yeah, so the baby just kind of gets a little blue when they're eating. Oh, okay. They're just not ready for this.
Blue is bad, y'all. Mm-hmm. Blue is bad.
Yeah.
But then you look at the flip side of it. You know, we're now looking at kids and the bedside, you see the little cards that say 32 weeks. We're doing early cue things with the baby, sucking on passies, doing passy dips, little syringe squirts in the side of the mouth. But even at 32 weeks, yeah, we're getting them ready for these things, but a lot of those kids aren't really exactly thrilled about it. Some of them love it and they do well, but if you don't pay attention to what happens when you do that, you can have that kid aspirate. You can set them backwards.
Yeah,
right. So really, yes, we need to be teaching the cue-based piece of it of my hands are to my mouth. I'm sucking. I'm alert. I'm awake. I look like I'm ready to feed. Okay, let's try the bottle. But when that baby starts acting like they're sputtering or choking
or gulping. I've seen people try to feed through gulping. And what are you doing?
Right. I feel like these babies would be much better served with a pacifier, and I'll hold you like you're eating while your feeding tube gives you your actual food. You know, like if you're trying to suck, if you're trying to do all these things, I would much rather you have a really positive experience and learn that something in my mouth is equal to something in my tummy, right? So that you start to have that association.
Yes.
Versus you're really not handling it well, and I'm going to keep trying to do that. And I think that's a big motivation for me as far as, you know, even this podcast is, I don't think it's fair for people to necessarily be judged by their clinical decisions if nobody's taught you the things that you really need to make sound clinical decisions, right? And when all you're seeing is, why aren't you feeding? You should be doing this. You should be doing that, without feeling really secure in your own practice and in the things that you know to be true and the things that you've seen and how they work, right? And for the baby, I think it's easy for nurses to then just kind of be like, oh, well, I'm going to do this because they tell me I'm supposed to do this.
Right.
And then where you're falling out a lot of times is on night shifts with your newer nurses. I know speech therapy doesn't want to be there in the middle of the night, but what group of nurses would probably benefit most
for
speech therapy is for them to be there at night.
100%.
These are your young nurses for the most part. If you learn something wrong, you have to unlearn it. And then you learn that muscle memory of how to feed. So why are, coming off the cuff of this, why are we not having speech therapy at night? Why are we not looking at that?
Right, we should be.
To have them in there teaching nurses from the get-go, this is how you do it appropriately. Versus, okay, this kid eats well all day long and they can't feed for a stink at night.
Right.
You hear it over and over, heard it over and over in my practice. My day shift nurse does so well. My baby eats horrible at night.
Right. But I think there's another piece to that that people leave out, which is sometimes your baby eats really, really well all day, and they use all of their reserve and all of their energy and all of their attention and all of their focus. And because it's being offered every single feed and it's being pushed every single feed, by the time I get there, I'm the old people at night that is totally comfortable with this. I see that kid looking tired. I see that if I offer you a bottle, we're going to make it 10 or 15 mLs in, and then you're going to be exhausted and we're going to have to give it to you. Whereas sometimes a nap, y'all, I don't know about you, but for me, like, a nap is the fixer of 90% of the problems of my life, right? So sometimes being able to get these kids a really good nap then makes them feel better, right? So then what happens? Well, then they had minimal cares. I changed their diaper. I took their temperature. I listened to them. I saw that they were tired. I tucked them back in. I left them alone. It's quiet at night. There's not as many people in there. So they get good sleep. Then they come in the daytime, and now they're ready to eat because they slept all night.
Right. So now for the babies that present to us in this moderate preterm category that have RDS. Maybe mom didn't get betamethasone. Maybe this baby comes to the unit. I mean, let's talk a little bit about RDS in these babies.
Sure. I feel like
respiratory distress.
Respiratory distress in this baby. So I have the nerve back somewhere, but about 30% of these kids are going to require some sort of ventilatory assistance. And when I say ventilatory assistance, I don't necessarily mean
intubated.
Intubated, exactly.
Right. And I mean, because ventilatory support is anything that is assisting in gas exchange.
Right. So 20 to 30% of these kids are going to require it. And there's an inverse correlation between gestation and the need for ventilation, meaning the earlier in this group you are, the more likely you are to require some help. But most of these kids really need some CPAP, right? They need a little help making sure that their alveoli open and stay open, and also that their airway is really kind of splinted open enough for all of those muscles to sort of start working together and developing and doing the things that they are still supposed to do.
Yes. And then when we start seeing an increase in that need for support, then we start talking about surfactant.
Although I feel like surfactant in this population is really much less common. Dr. Richard Poland, who is at Morgan Stanley Children's Hospital in New York, is kind of the guru. And he says all babies will make their own surfactant regardless of gestation at 24 hours of life. So a lot of it really comes down to how well did we sustain them for that first 24 hours, and how well did we support their own ability to do what they need to do. And I think that is much better in these babies, and also, you know, why we don't see as much surfactant
in this gestation. I agree. Yep. Yeah.
Although I do think there's another piece to this respiratory distress, and it goes back to the idea that NICU admission is a risk factor, because if you have nurses who are feeding through gulping, or who say, well, the baby is really cueing, I know he's on CPAP, but he really, really wants his bottle. Y'all can't see the faces they just made. They just made faces. But you have this. So what happens? We have these babies who are having these little micro aspirations and silent aspirations, and it's setting them up for respiratory distress that has nothing to do with
their
gestation.
Prematurity.
Right.
Right.
Right. And I do think that that's, you know, most definitely a piece of the respiratory distress in these babies. The other thing that we haven't talked about yet, I kind of glanced about it, but temp instability in these kids.
Thermoregulation in these babies, even 34 weekers that we have kind of lumped in here, they're just not ready to regulate their own temperature.
Mm-mm. Right. So babies stay warm with non-shivering thermogenesis, right? Brown fat metabolism. And brown fat stores, even though they start developing around 28 weeks, they don't actually really start developing with any sort of like significance until 32, 33 weeks. And then that's part of that rapid weight gain that mom has towards the end of her pregnancy. Once you use up the brown fat you have in these babies, it's really gone. Although there's some crazy studies about brown fat in adults and how it keeps you skinny forever.
That sounds like something you could put in your blog.
Yeah, I will, because I totally geeked out over that. I didn't know that adults ever had brown fat.
Anyway,
once that brown fat store is used up, it's gone, right? So if these babies are in the delivery room and somebody wants to hold them up and show mom and dad, and you've got the currents in the delivery room and the baby's a little chilly, right?
All convection, is that current?
Yes.
It is.
I couldn't get there.
What if you leave the baby wet? What if you don't dry this baby?
That's a terrible idea.
Insensible. Heat loss and water loss
through
evaporation.
Yeah, if you haven't taken your boards yet.
Yeah, it's definitely on your certification exam. It's 100.
Oh, that is all over the certification exam. Hint, hint.
Other huge part of thermoregulation in these kids is I gave him a bath. Y'all, the baby was on CPAP. He was doing so good. He came off of CPAP. He's on room air. He was smelling a little funny because there was some choreo, so I decided to scrub him up because look how cute he is.
Look at his hair.
Don't do it. Please don't do it.
Don't do it.
But his hair's all matted, Michelle.
Let it be matted. Put a hat on. You can't see it. It'll be fine.
But Mama's over there in postpartum, and this baby really needs footprints. And I have to wash the ink off.
Are his feet going to fall off in the next day or two?
But look how cute he is.
No. Like I said, the feet will still be there.
I cannot even...
I mentioned
it before, but honestly, I've seen kids 34, 35 weeks who were doing great, so I gave them a bath. And we had a baby one time at a facility where I was that was from CPAP to ECMO.
Because the nurse needed to get the mat out of the head.
Because the nurse needed him to have fuzzy hair.
It still makes me cringe to this day. And that's been many, many years ago that happened.
So the point is, bathing these babies too early sends them into a tailspin.
Right.
A rapid tailspin.
So you were talking earlier about, before we started recording, about the caloric needs. Why don't you say all of that again? Because it was very, very smart.
Well, so one more thing about heat loss. What happens if I take this baby out of its incubator and put it onto a cold scale? Anybody?
What? Conduction. That's conductive heat loss.
That's conductive heat loss.
What's going on that
You
scale?
Did manage to get all four in there, didn't you?
Did I do all of them?
Yes, you did.
The last one wasn't so smooth, though.
No, but that's all right.
Okay, so what are the biggest expenditures of energy for babies? And I go through this with parents all the time. The biggest expenditures of energy are eating and thermoregulation. So even when these babies are skin to skin, we don't want their back exposed to the air because that's 50% of their body surface area that they have to thermoregulate. And the other half is on mom or dad. And so we want to put a warm blanket over the baby's back and a hat on, even when they're skin to skin. The other thing we don't want to do is constantly pull them out of the incubator to feed them, because now they're doing both of these things at the same time. And so we don't want to unwrap these babies to try and wake them up to feed them. If they're falling asleep while you're trying to feed them, they're done. That's it. You don't unwrap them. You don't take their hat off. You don't scratch their head to see if you can wake them up. They're done. They get the rest of their feed through the NG tube because they will end up burning through calories to stay warm and to eat. And what you end up seeing is their weight then starts to trend down.
I mean, to be fair, that's not the baby's fault. That's our fault.
Right. And so that's another thing that I explain to parents when this baby starts to thermoregulate and come out of the incubator and we put the baby in the bassinet and we start to see the baby's weight trend down, even though they're maintaining temperatures. These babies could have perfectly stable temperatures and they're eating all of their bottles and that weight starts to dip. We really, as care providers, should consider putting that baby back in an isolate.
I think that the struggle a lot of times that nurses experience is you want to be able to show parents that their baby is doing well and growing up. And for a lot of parents, the idea that the baby's in a regular bed, he looks like every other newborn, is the thing that makes them feel like the baby is doing well. So a lot of times nurses are very hesitant to make the call that says, I know he was in a bassinet, but I need to put him back in the incubator because he really needs the extra support right now. It's just too much work for him.
Well, and neurological development is really strongly correlated with growth.
Yes.
Head circumference, average head circumference increases and length.
And I feel like it's interesting, you know, the idea of mom, baby, dyad as a mom, right? Think about when your babies were first born and oh my God, it was so much work and it was so overwhelming and I had no idea what I was doing. And if somebody could have come in and said, Rebecca, why don't you just go take a nap and I'll do this, I'd have been all over it. I feel like maybe being able to change the conversation to where we can say to parents, really, I'm just saying to the baby, go take a nap and I'll handle this part. And then what happens when you finally did get that nap and you came back, all of a sudden it wasn't as overwhelming. You were a little bit more able to manage. You could handle all of it a little bit easier. I feel like it's the same thing for these kids. You know, they They are working very, very hard.
I know. I was talking to somebody the other night, and they worked at a facility. They would not take the babies out of the incubators until they were fully bottle feeding.
Interesting. It's kind of brilliant.
It's so brilliant.
Yeah, it's kind of brilliant.
Sounds like research.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yay. And on the flip side of that, being the devil's advocate.
Go for it.
Yeah, you say that, but what if you've got that older kid? I mean, we were born at 34 weeks. We're now 36 weeks. We still are not bottle feeding, and in that incubator, my temperature's off at 101, and I'm acting a fool. I mean, it's a fine line between the two.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, we touched on that in the beginning of the episode. Like, the lines are not hard. They're not hard lines.
They're not hard lines, but just somebody think, oh, let's push for this in my facility. You need to think about the other things, too.
Well, and I think that that is an important piece of practice guidelines.
And judgment.
Right? Guidelines are a brilliant thing in that it's guidance. It's not a hard and fast rule. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you have to have the clinical judgment behind it to be able to make really sound decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think it makes sense to keep a baby in an incubator that's set at 25 degrees.
Right.
If that's what it takes for the baby to be able to not overheat, just let him be in a bed and leave it be. Also, if you have a nurse who's hot flashing and you've got the nursery set at 68 degrees and that baby is not warm enough, maybe it's not the baby's fault.
Correct.
Right? Maybe we need to look at that piece too. So it is, you're right, Michelle, like it's important, I think, to have it as a guideline, a sort of suggestion.
Yeah, guidelines are a better way. I know people want the guidelines or they want the policy. And going from a facility that had some pretty ABCD type guidelines and policies to a facility that is not so structured has made, I feel like I use a lot more critical thinking, and I feel like I'm questioned a lot more on my decisions.
And I like the happy medium. I want the policies, and I wrote the policies that said, if you have this, then try this, and if you have this, then try this, and if you have this, then try this, because they're all guidelines, and also they're all covered.
I love it when I do something and people stand there and they watch me do that thing like I'm crazy and I actually do that thing and then they're like, why did you do that?
Yeah.
And I'm like, let me tell you why I did that.
Yes. Maybe because I have a weird ability to remember baby things, even though I can't remember anything in like my actual life, I feel like people stop asking me that question. I feel like they don't want to know.
Like, why are you doing that?
Because the verbal vomit comes out. Like, oh, there was a study and blah, 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 blah. And people are just like you watch their eyes glaze over. Y'all do it too.
I do.
I'm sitting here going, yep.
Yep.
What else with these babies, these moderately preterm babies?
I feel like the last big thing is really the jaundice, the hyperbilirubinemia.
I feel like we hit on this in every gestational age. Like,
well,
jaundice,
we keep hitting on it. It's like part of being born.
I feel like jaundice is baby plague.
Baby plague?
Plague, baby plague.
Oh, I thought you said plague at first, like I'm outside playing.
No, I got plague, but I'm like, people die from the plague. I feel
not
like it's
plagues.
More like a baby
no.
leg cramp.
No, not all baby. No, not all people die from the plague. 40% of people live.
That's not.
I did not think that 60% of these babies died from jaundice.
I don't know. I think I've not really seen very. No, come on. There's different plagues.
I feel like when you say the plague, I'm really super like, oh
wait,
my God, we're all going to die.
What do you think about when you think of the plague?
It's the COVID. I'm thinking about the ring around the rosies, pocket
yes.
full of posies.
You're thinking of the bubonic plague.
Yes.
There's been other plagues.
Okay. Can we just pick a word that isn't plague?
No.
It's COVID-19.
Can it be like baby like flu? Baby COVID-19. Like,
no, it's jaundice.
Anyway.
It's jaundice.
So jaundice, I feel like jaundice is going to be part of every gestation, though, because what is jaundice, right? Jaundice
it's
is
baby
this,
plague.
No. It is this buildup of bilirubin, which is a product of red cells being destroyed, right? So these kids
wait a minute.
Have all these extra red cells on board anyway. No,
and then
I'm,
they break down.
Right.
And the baby's liver is not mature enough to filter them out.
Correct.
And so the baby turns yellow, kind of like a zombie.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Lord. How did we get on zombies?
Because her plague.
Okay.
I think that there's this one other thing that I'm going to go ahead and say right now. In the NICU, you have got to learn to laugh. Because if you don't,
do.
You will cry. I think it's important. Anyway, not the baby plague, not zombies. But yes, they do turn yellow. I would say they look like Maggie Simpson, like they've been sucking on a highlighter.
Right. Both of my babies had jaundice. So anyway.
So how do you get rid of jaundice, right? Two ways.
Poop.
Only these kids, their peristalsis isn't really great, right? Coordinated peristalsis doesn't really start. Peristalsis happens, right? But coordinated peristalsis is really like 34, 35, 36, 37 kind of weeks.
And then you add on top of that, some of these babies have been exposed to mag sulfate, like we talked earlier.
And also the idea that sometimes you got to get full before you have an urge to empty. I mean, this is true in all things, right? So if we're not feeding these kids at full volume or whatever they're trying to take, they're not really getting enough stim that tells them that they need to poop. So if you're not pooping,
then you're going to get your baby tan in bed.
Right.
With the baby sunglasses that they never want to keep on, ever.
Yeah. So you want to increase these babies' fluid intake. Right. And that'll really help assist the liver in kind of filtering this out. And then it does dump into the GI tract through the biliary system.
I usually will say to my attending, would you like me to start an IV? Or would you like me to drop an NG and increase this kid's volume?
Fair questions.
Because it one or the other has to happen. And I also need for you to know that I've already thought through those things. And this is what I'm anticipating. If you're going to give me another answer, that's cool, but we're going to have a conversation about why.
And so a lot of these kids, I would say the majority of them, end up on Billy Lights.
At some point, usually for a minute or two.
For a little bit. And they get the super cool sunglasses that they don't want to keep on. They hate them.
And also trying to explain to parents that, no, you can't hold the baby because he really needs to be on phototherapy right now. Mm-hmm. Really quick note on phototherapy, only because people have asked me probably at least every other week for the last few months, your Billy meter should read between 12 and 18 for each light. There's abbreviations that go with those light levels. I always mess them up. I'm just going to tell you your Billy meter should read between 12 and 18 for each light.
Yeah, you do want to make sure that your lights are within therapeutic range, and they should really be tested every shift. I don't know what other facilities do. I know the first facility that I worked at, we tested them every shift.
Every shift.
And then that is something that I've carried with me through my practice.
Same.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Same. I'm a little obsessive about it usually.
Right. As you should be, because it really helps these kids and it really prevents, poor neurological outcomes.
Right, because the solution to untreated jaundice is kernicterus.
Right.
Which is brain scramble, really. I mean, the implications of that are huge and devastating.
Right.
So I think sometimes, you see this and you're like, he's on phototherapy. There are big issues that come out of not treating it or not treating it appropriately, which is part of why I think I became obsessive about Billy meter,
Right. And I do think that NICU's approach management conservatively, which means that these babies are treated at a lower threshold than your full-term babies.
Right.
I would like to say across the board, again, the facilities that I have worked at, our preterm babies are all managed conservatively. Some term babies that I've, some practices that I've worked with term babies are not so conservative. They would rather not just kind of jump on giving a baby formula to increase the fluids, and they just kind of stick with mom breastfeeding for your full-term babies and kind of see if the baby will work through it a little bit. Preterm babies, I mean, it's a different ballgame, so.
Yeah, that's true.
I just laugh because my term baby had very high Billy levels and breastfeeding just did not happen. She was too tired.
Mm-hmm. Which is true, too.
And they get tired.
Like, makes you feel bad. It feels like a bad flu is the way it's been explained to me before. And so you don't really want to eat well. You don't really want
tired
to participate.
So I explain that to parents in this way. I say, your baby's bilirubin levels are high. This is what bilirubin is. This is how we get rid of it. Now, that being said, these broken down red blood cells are a part of your baby's blood volume. However, they do not carry oxygen because it's a broken down cell, it's non-functional. And so the baby's tired, think about how it feels to be anemic. And that's mm-hmm. been kind of my go-to
You're
comparison.
So I love it.
Thank you.
All right, and on that note of smarticles.
Wait, when you say I'm smart, do you mean I can critically think?
You can, and your clinical judgment is on point all the time.
Thank you so much.
I'm just saying. Okay, wait, before we end, actually I do want to make one more weird little side note.
Is it about the baby plague?
No, it's also not about zombies. Y'all, when you're drawing your bilirubin levels, please don't forget to turn your billy light off.
What?
Yes, please, Lord.
You would feel like this is something that goes without saying. However, to be fair, full disclosure, I have gotten halfway through drawing a billy and realized that my light was still on and had to start again because clearly that's not a fair measurement. So yeah. I figure if I had a squirrel brain moment enough to do it, it's worth mentioning.
I do think that sometimes we get used to taking care of the baby with the lights on.
And you forget to pay attention.
And you forget to shut them off when you're doing the billy level. And I have definitely gotten all the way through the billy level and I've just said to myself, Darla.
So wait, I'm not the only one that's done that?
I've done it too, but I can take it a step further.
Did you send it?
No.
Oh.
I will draw the billy level, put my bullet in the bed, and turn the light back on with my blood in the bullet.
Nice.
And then I'm like, oh man, we gotta do this all over again.
We've all done it.
Yes. Which is in no way a reflection of your ability to critically think or on your excellent clinical judgment. That's what we call a squirrel brain moment, which is part of being human.
And we've all done it.
We've all done it. It's like everybody's fed a bed at least once.
At least once.
If you haven't ever fed a bed, y'all, it's because you haven't been a NICU nurse very long. Give it time.
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
It will happen.
It will happen. All right. And on that note, anything else?
Do you feel like we've covered everything with moderately preterm babies?
I do. I feel like we've covered it.
The big topics.
You guys think we've covered it? All right.
Yeah.
So thanks for hanging out with us. Next week, we're going to talk about the tiny ones, which is totally where I geek out. That has been my heart for a long time. If you have any feedback for us, if you have things that you want to hear about, you want to hear us talk about, please absolutely hit us up. We're on all the socials, and you can find us at NICU-resources.com on our internet page. Just kidding. On our webpage. That was on purpose. It was from an outtake. It was funny. All right.
Yes.
Thanks
please,
so much.
Please feel free to visit us. Let us know what you think. Thank you for listening.